When I was about 12 years old or so, and I have no idea why, I somewhat suddenly got really interested in tennis. And for me, it first started as watching tennis on television, watching the professionals play. In those days, the ones at the top of the rankings were Pete Sampras and Andre Agassi. On the men's side, it was Steffi Graf and Martina Navratilova. And Monica Seles on the women's side. I didn't watch the in-between tournaments, but I really made sure that I was in front of the TV to watch the Grand Slam tournaments, to watch the U.S. Open and the French Open and the Australian Open and Wimbledon. Especially loved Wimbledon and kind of the royalty of all that happened there. I loved watching tennis. I don't watch it as much anymore, but I loved it in that time. And watching it got me interested in playing it. Now, the only problem for me was that I didn't live within walking distance of any tennis courts at the time, so I was pretty limited. But I did live right beside the church. And the back of the church was nothing but bricks. There were no windows on the back of the church. And our driveway went right behind the church, and so did our neighbor's driveway. So there was some pavement back there. So that became my tennis court. I would play against the wall. It turns out, by the way, if you play against a wall, you can never hit a winner. The wall always returns the shot, it turns out. Unless you miss the wall, and then you have to go chasing your tennis ball down the busy street, which was also an interesting thing I had to do. So I really got into tennis. I really enjoyed it. I'd spend hours out back hitting the tennis ball against the wall, imagining that I was there at Wimbledon or at the Australian Open or whatever it was, that I was matched up against Pete Sampras or Andre Agassi or whoever the person might have been at the time. I learned a lot about tennis, learned a bit about strategy, and one of the things I learned very early on is how tennis is scored. Those of you who play tennis or know tennis know that it has kind of a strange scoring system, right? For each point, you don't just gain 1 point. It goes from 0 to 15 to 30 to 40, and then after that, you win, which is really strange. I have no idea why that's the case. I'm not here to solve that mystery. I'm just telling you the way it is. It also always reminds me, 0 in tennis is love, right? They call it love, if you have 0-0 against one another. And it reminds me of one of my favorite jokes, which is, why do you never date a tennis player? Because to them, love means nothing. Isn't that good? That's one of those ones you can tell anybody and probably not offend anybody, so you can hold on to that one, right? Right. So, but one of the other strange parts of tennis scoring is if the players are back and forth and they get to the place where they both have 40 points, so they've each kind of earned 4 points, then that enters into deuce. Those of you who play tennis know this. It's deuce. Now, once you're in deuce, you enter in this whole new arena of scoring wherein the next person to score after deuce is given the advantage. So it's advantage Sampras, for instance, right? If you have advantage and you win the next point, you win the game. But if you have advantage and you lose the next point, you just go back to deuce. And then you have to do it again, and either you get advantage or your partner gets it. So in other words, once you're into deuce, somebody has to win 2 points in a row to be able to end that game in particular. And so it is that in tennis, if you have advantage, not only are you on the cusp of winning, in that moment, at least for the next point, you can't lose. To have advantage means you can't lose. I want to talk a little bit about advantage today, and in this way, piggyback a little bit off of the message that I preached last week. As I stood before you last week, I commended to you how important it is for those of us who are within the church, and especially those of us who have a heart for and who love the church, to be willing to be critical of the church. To point out the flaws of the church. It is not a perfect institution. We are not a perfect people. And it is important for us to point out the ways in which those flaws get in the way of our being faithful to the ministry and the work that we are called to by God. Today I want to talk a little bit about how advantage does that for us. You know, history is recorded from the perspective of the advantaged. More often than not, as we look back, we look at the history of the advantaged because the disadvantaged at any given time doesn't have the opportunity or the power or the authority to record their own story. And our Bible, our scripture, which is in many ways a history text, not all, but in many ways a history text, is also a place where it is the story of the advantaged. So, Abraham. At the almost very beginning of the story, Abraham is given a blessing by God. Your ancestors will number as many as the stars in the sky. Abraham has advantage. And then Moses comes along, and Moses is ordained by God to lead God's people out of Egypt and into the promised land. Moses is given advantage, and the people, as they enter into the promised land, are given advantage because they are given God's blessing. David comes along, and he defeats Goliath, and in defeating Goliath, becomes the king of Israel. He is given advantage. He's given the blessing of God, the covenant by which God promises to always have an heir of David on the throne of Israel. Even as we get into the New Testament, we find this theme of the advantage that God gives. Jesus himself says to his people, "You did not choose me, I chose you." God's choosing, God's blessing leads to advantage. But here's the ironic twist. The other thing that's true of our scriptures is that many times, even after God has moved in a way to give advantage to someone or to a people, God then often moves against that advantage. We see that most clearly in the story of the Israelite people. After they had settled in the promised land, things were going well, but then they forgot who they were and whose they were, and God is a jealous God. And God moved against their advantage and ultimately sent them into exile. The passage from Isaiah that you heard Noah read just a moment ago is a prophecy that was given to the people of Israel who were in exile at the time. And God had already then moved against their advantage and had exiled them out of the promised land, scattered them around the area. But God was moving again to restore advantage to God's people in this moment, but in a very interesting way. God had chosen, and it was Isaiah's message to give to the people, God had chosen to restore the advantage of the Israelite people by using a Gentile emperor, Cyrus of Persia. In that passage, in the first verse that Noah read, you may have heard the word anointed. Cyrus is God's anointed. That is the same exact word that is translated in many other places, Messiah. And so the word from Isaiah to the people of Israel is, your Messiah, who is going to return you to your place of advantage, is none other than a Gentile king. And the people rebelled. They were in exile, they were miserable. They wanted nothing more than to return to their land, to the Holy Land, the land of their ancestors, but they were certain it was not going to happen at the hands of a Gentile king, and so they rejected that. But God spoke harshly to them and said, Who set the earth into motion? Was it you? This is my plan, and this is how it's going to happen, and indeed it did. God restored their advantage, but with a twist. By using someone who was anything but advantaged in their eyes, a Gentile king, to restore that advantage. Fast forward a few hundred years and we get to the text from Acts for today. As you heard Alan explain, this text for today comes immediately after Peter has his famous vision. He falls asleep and the sheet comes down from heaven three different times filled with all kinds of unclean animals. It comes down from God with the command to Peter, eat, kill and eat, kill and eat. And each time Peter responds and says, I cannot eat what is unclean. And God's response is, do not call unclean what I have called clean. Peter begins to understand that this isn't simply about dietary restrictions for the people of Israel, that God's vision is much bigger than that. And so in the first part of the passage we heard read for today, Peter's eyes are open and he says to the people, I now understand that God shows no partiality. In other words, those of us who thought we were just in this small group of people that were favored by God, it's a much bigger group now. God is opening the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ, not just to Jewish believers, but to Gentiles as well. And in the same way that many of the Israelites responded to the news that a Gentile king was going to be their Messiah, many responded to Peter in the same way and said, no, how can it be? We are the chosen people of God. We are the advantage. They are not. But Peter and Paul and God persisted. And many of us are part of the faith today because they did. Because God opened and turned that idea of advantage on its head so that it wasn't just for the Jews anymore, it was for all people. what I think was most concerning to the people who responded as they did, first in Isaiah and then to the message that came from Peter, those who would say, no, that can't be the way, what was most concerning for them was they thought they were going to lose so much. They thought in not being a part of the advantaged anymore, they had a lot to lose. And I think that's because they were functioning, as so many of us do, from a position of scarcity. From an understanding of life and the world and the way that God works in the world, seeing it as a zero-sum game. So that if I lose, if you are to gain some advantage, it means that I have to lose advantage, and there's only so much that goes around, and I'm not willing to give that up. I'm advantage, not you. If you get it, I lose, and I can't stand for that. But that is, I would propose, antithetical to the gospel message. For the gospel message of Jesus Christ is not a message of scarcity. It is a message of abundance. Look no further than the story that is recorded in all four gospels, not many are, of Jesus feeding the 5,000. 5,000 men, plus women and children, hungry. Jesus tells the disciples to feed them. What do they have? 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. That's not enough to feed 15, 20,000 people. And yet Jesus blesses it, breaks it, sends it out. And not only is there enough for everyone to eat their fill, not only is it equal for everyone, 12 baskets full come back filled with leftovers. That is the message of abundance of Jesus Christ. That is a message to the advantaged that the way you're looking at this may not be the way you should. So what does that have to do with us? What does that have to do with those of us sitting here in a church in 21st century America? Well, I have something to propose to you that maybe you haven't thought of it this way, but probably it comes as no surprise to you. We are living in a time, I believe, when the white, wealthy Western church is being faced with the decline of its advantage. Our advantage as a church, as the Protestant church in America, is falling down all around us. The advantage that we have enjoyed for generation after generation, the church that we're in today is not the same church of 20, 30, 50 years ago. Our advantage is eroding around us. And so there is the problem that is set before us. The advantage that was given to us or that we claimed is no longer there, and it's slipping away even more day by day by day. And it may very well be true if we believe that God at times works to remove advantage, that that truth is something that God is working towards God's self. Not something that's just happening, but that God may be behind it. And so that begs the question, how do we respond? What do we do? If our advantage as a church is falling down around us, how do we respond to that? And I think we have one of two options. I think if we buy into the message of scarcity and we see this advantage that we've held for so long falling around us, then we have no choice but to dig in our heels and fight for every inch that we can. We can't lose any more ground. Because if we lose it, somebody else gets it. And that can't be. But there's another response. If we look at it from a perspective of abundance, then we need not fear. Those who dig in their heels do so usually out of a sense of fear and anxiety, a sense of great loss. But if it's not a zero-sum game, if we believe that God gives enough for everyone, then as those who have been disadvantaged for years begin to receive what they have longed for so long, and we lose a little bit of what we've had, it's a leveling of the field, and that's okay. Mostly because God is at work. Mostly because our God is an abundant God and can and will provide everything that we need, even as those things that we cling to fall away. Now, why is it that God would ever move against advantage? Why is it that God would ever give advantage to a people and then move to take it away? look at the Israelites. What happened when they made it to the promised land and were given what God had promised even after all of their complaining? They made it into the promised land, the land flowing with milk and honey. They were living the good life. And who did they forget? And who became their God and their idol? Their advantage became their idol and their God. And they forgot about the one God of Israel who had given them that advantage in the first place. I think in many ways, the church in the 21st century is faced with the fact, and we have to wrestle with the fact, that we may have been given advantage, but we have lifted that advantage up as an idol. And we have worshipped that advantage much more than we have worshipped the God who ever would have even given it to us in the first place or blessed us with it. And so we are called to respond. I think this is true, by the way, for more than just the church, and maybe you've sensed this too, especially in this political season, election season. I think the same is true of our country. I think in many ways those who have been advantaged for so long are seeing that that advantage is slipping away. And those who have been disadvantaged for so long are starting to see that they are getting what it is that they have yearned for so long. And so in the world and in our country and in our church, we are faced with this dilemma, this choice. As our advantage is crumbling down around us, as it is going away and we are facing a new reality, we can look at it as total loss. And we can do everything in our power to fight from that loss. Dig in our heels and sit tight and hope that this passes and we can somehow restore that advantage on our own. Or we can take a step back and we can look at where maybe God's hand is at work in our lives, in our church, in our country, in our world, moving against the advantage of some to the benefit of others, and recognize that just because others get some doesn't mean we lose all. I think the latter of those is the more faithful response. It takes a lot of trust, and it takes a lot of faith. It takes a willingness to look beyond our own particular needs and desires to the greater good of the people of God and the people of the world. But I believe it is the more faithful response. By the time I started getting interested in tennis, John McEnroe was retired. Some of you know the name John McEnroe. I came to know the name John McEnroe. I know he's a tennis player. I've seen some video of him playing in the past. But the first thing you hear about John McEnroe is rarely about the quality of his tennis play. What you learn about John McEnroe, almost first and foremost, was his temper. Here's the thing about John McEnroe. He may have been a great tennis player, but any time he lost advantage, he threw a tantrum. The question is, how are we going to respond when we lose our advantage? In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.